Welcome to Theatre Voice. My name's Heather Neal, and I'm with Bill Buckhurst in a break from rehearsals for the Globe to Globe Hamlet, which he's directing with Dominic Drumgoole, and which will shortly leave for a two-year tour, taking in every country in the world. Well, Bill is an experienced Globe director, and at present has on stage at the Globe itself this year's Deutsche Bank playing Shakespeare production, and that is The Merchant of Venice, which we're going to talk about. Hamlet, we can't talk about yet, but I hope we'll come back to that another day. So, The Merchant of Venice. This production is mainly for school children, isn't it? Though this year not exclusively. So it seems a quite daring choice of play for schools. How did you come to choose The Merchant of Venice?
Well, it wasn't my personal choice. The education team proposed it to me as an idea for this year's show, and it's a really fantastically unique project. This, as you said, the audience is predominantly made up of young teenagers from inner city schools, and in fact the age group is really, we're sort of targeting 14-year-olds. Quite a tricky age, young teenagers. And this partnership with Deutsche Bank has been going for about 8 years now. And over these 8 years, we've played to about 95,000 young people.
It's about 24,000 this year.
About 24,000.
Because it's going on much longer than it has before.
Absolutely, yeah. Every year it's sort of grown, the number of performances we've given. And it's not just unique in the fact that we're targeting, our audiences are predominantly 14-year-olds. The majority of these audiences come in completely free of charge. The doors of the Globe are open for this year, three and a bit weeks, and around 16,000 young people from state schools here in London will see this play free. And for many of these young people, it will be their first experience of seeing Shakespeare, let alone coming to the Globe. And for some people, some of them, as you understand it, this will be their very first experience of going to the theatre at all. So it's a really wonderful, extraordinary project. And as well as doing the show, of course, there's a whole load of other activities going on around the show. CPD days for teachers, based on, specifically tailored for this show, as well as many, many workshops for young people coming in to the Globe, and also outreach as well. Of course, a fantastic website based on Merchant of Venice, award-winning team working on it this year, and it's a fantastic resource which students from around the world have been using. So it's really fantastic. It's a tough audience, no doubt about it. I think I've been lucky enough to have been involved with this project since the very beginning. I was an actor at the time, and I was in the very first production, which was Much Ado About Nothing. And we learnt an awful lot that year in terms of what it's like to deal with that kind of energy inside a space like the Globe. 1,500 young people, as I said before, many of whom have never been to the theatre before, yeah. Experiencing Shakespeare for the first time. There are certain things one has to sort of be aware of during performance.
Yes, well, there are good things about that. I mean, I thought it was fascinating to see them. Some of the ones in the pit really worried that their pound of flesh was going to get cut off. They were really frightened.
Absolutely. I mean, that's the joy of this space, isn't it? The Globe. I mean, a theatre space which does not allow you as an audience member to sit back and sort of like fall asleep in the dark with the auditorium lights, when the auditorium lights come off. I mean, you are involved in the storytelling from the very, very beginning. And, just come back to your question about why this play was chosen. Well, as I said, I mean, this was proposed to me, and I remember thinking at first, ooh, crikey, that's a bold choice. If the young people coming into the theatre are anything like what I was like at that age, I might have struggled with a play, Merchant of Venice. So I thought. because I thought, well, you know, it's not like when we've done, you know, Macbeth or Romeo and Juliet, Midsummer Night's Dream, plays which young people may be more familiar with, I suppose. The stories, the plays themselves are, you know, are perhaps studied more often at schools. Mm. I was thinking Merchant of Venice is not one which is, you know, at the top of the list in terms of ones which teachers may choose to work with the students.
Well, a lot of people specifically avoid it, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, they do. I mean, some of the issues I think probably are seen within the play are perhaps seen to be, you know, very challenging.
Yeah.
And that has been, and yeah, I think, you know, as well, when the department were thinking about doing the play, I know they did speak to some teachers, and I'm sure, I believe some of them, you know, did turn around and think, oh, and say, oh, you know, this might not be a, you know, a great play to do because of, you know, keeping the audience attention, et cetera, et cetera. Well, I'm very, very, very pleased to say that we've found it to be a brilliantly positive experience, and has surprised us all in terms of the, you know, the attention that the audiences are given to the play and the discussion that has come out of
the play. Well, because that's the huge advantage of tackling something with so many different difficult problems in it, that there's always going to be so much to talk about, and they must have had plenty of lesson fodder out of it, I should think, resources.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things, you know, I made sure to do before you know directing it was to go and talk to some young people at schools to find out what they thought about it, what their impressions were, because I was genuinely intrigued to know if this was a play which would you know interest a young audience. And I mean I was really delighted by their sort of enthusiasm for the play, for talking about the subjects raised by the play. And, you know...
Let's talk about Shylock. Obviously, this is at the centre of this, the possible anti-Semitism. So you've got to get enough subtlety into his characterisation and into the treatment of him, haven't you, to give them something to talk about. So it's billed as a comedy, but it's not just a comedy for us, anyway.
No, I think that's I think this is one of the powers of the play, and the reason why it's been such a success with our young audiences is the fact that, you know, isn't it the case that, you know, you can pack quite a punch when things are veiled behind, you know, comedy. Mm. And I think that's, you know, that's been quite a shock for the audiences when they... Sometimes, for example, I've watched the show, and we have this moment. I think probably I should say actually at this point that we use obviously all of Shakespeare's language in these productions. There's no sort of, like, you know, inverted commas dumbing down with these shows. I mean, this is you know, we're using his language. The only sort of concession, as it were, that we do make with these shows is that they're cut. So I made a this one runs at about an hour and 40 minutes, straight through with that interval. I think one of the things I've been really interested to see is sort of the expectation of the audience maybe to dislike Shylock, which is kind of fascinating. Maybe some of them who know the play don't know the play quite so well. They see him come on stage, and I've seen some audiences kind of boo when he's walked on stage, and then to see that audience completely sort of disarmed by the journey of the character, by his "Have Not a Jew Eyes" speech, and his exit at the end of the trial scene, and seeing this and hearing the silence in the space, the turnaround in their opinion about a character.
Yes. Well, I think that's very well done. They really do feel this is unjust, and you can feel a ripple in the audience. But that's down to the production, because you don't often always get that in productions, you know. I mean, people don't always sympathise as much with him, see things from his point of view by this time. There was a real sense of shock, I thought, when I was there.
Yeah, there was, and quite right too.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's... it's fantastic. I think that they really follow his story. I mean, I think that, you know, we can all relate to feeling isolated.
This is the forced conversion at the end and taking absolutely everything he owns.
Absolutely. And I think there's something about, for the young people watching, it's like, there's one thing to sort of like destroy him in terms of, taking all his money and just, you know, ruining his livelihood, etc., etc. I mean, you know, he's already lost his daughter. But it's that moment when he's told he has to convert to Christianity, like his identity has been erased. Yes. His heritage, his sense of being, his sense of, you know, identity is scrubbed out in an instant. And I think that's something which the young people have absolutely gone crazy about. They've just, they can't bear that sense.
No, it's really very interesting to see that. But because on the other side of that, you've then got Portia, who does the quality of mercy speech and shows none at all, really, does she? Isn't that quite difficult? I mean, she's not just the pretty heroine that she used to be when this play was done 40, 50 years ago.
No, she's an extraordinary character. I mean, I think that's the thing about this play, which, again, it feels incredibly sophisticated and very, very modern, is the fact that it's full of ambiguity. It's full of... I mean, let's think. I mean, the play opens with these young, kind of attractive young guys. One of them seems quite unhappy. He says he says as much. It doesn't really explain why he's sad. So immediately we may feel a sympathy towards him. We are introduced to these characters. This young guy Bassanio, his friend, who's really wants to win the girl and. Then the sort of amusing character Gratiano, but this group of kind of attractive, on the surface, young men, who gradually let us down. In the first scene,
although Bassanio sort of hints that his reason for going to woo Portia is because he needs some cash. I mean, it's basically, isn't it?
Yeah. Yes, it is. I mean, it's brilliant actually when he's sort of persuaded by Antonio to spill the beans about this girl, and he goes, well, there is a lady richly left,
yes,
and she is fair as well. It's rather brilliant, and I mean, it sets up this world very neatly, doesn't it, which is this world of people always on the make, always looking for the next best thing. Obviously money's essential for these men and women living in this society. And you've got this classic character who's living way beyond his means. Yes, it doesn't. He sets up the stall. I suppose Shakespeare sets up the stall in terms of the world that they're dealing with rather well in that first scene. But there's still something, you know. This world, may, in some ways, doesn't feel a million miles away from the world we live in now. Mm. You know, I think you only have to open, you know, any of these magazines now. But the pictures are all of, you know, celebrities sunning themselves in, you know, exotic places, hanging out in these very expensive bars where we know, you know, bottles of champagne are £20,000 or whatever. You know, perhaps setting up this aspirational kind of lifestyle. I think that, you know, that's the kind of world he's talking about, isn't it?
Portia's almost like two people, really, isn't she? She's the sort of fairy tale heroine, and she's also a very, very tough, intelligent woman.
Absolutely. I mean, the sort of, again, this is the kind of cloudiness of these characters. She's an attractive personality. You know, she's bright, she's sparky, she's strong. And she throws these kind of curveballs at us as an audience. I mean, there's that wonderfully tricky moment at the end of the scene with Morocco, where she turns around and says, "Let all of his complexion choose me so." And it's the last line of the scene, and we're immediately into the next one. And we're left with this very, very bad taste in our mouths.
Yes, it's not. Yes, the anti-Semitism isn't the only cruelty in the play, is it?
No, it isn't.
There's racism, but there's also the treatment of old Gobbo as well, which is, for us, quite difficult. The old blind father.
It's extraordinary. I mean, I think it's a rather brilliant scene in many ways. I wanted to keep. I mean, sometimes that scene is cut. I believe, and you know, when you're working with them.
This is the Gobbos.
The Gobbos, yeah. When you're trying to create a cut of an hour 40 minutes, I mean, it's a lot has to go. And I felt it was very important to keep the main structure of the play intact, and that included that scene for the very reason that you said, because it's another example it's a blind man. This is another group being attacked, and not just that, but by his own son, and to sort of make fun of him and to make us laugh. In some ways, I feel that, you know, Shakespeare's kind of goading us to see how far we'll go for a laugh, and to sort of make us question what we find funny and why we find it funny. In the same way that, you know, in the scene where Portia's talking to Nerissa and, you know, talking about the suitors and, you know, basically, you know, these national stereotypes being, you know, being brought out. And
which you do go for. I mean, really over the top and make them comic characters.
Absolutely. And I think that's what he's
yes,
doing.
You can't do it any other way.
I mean, I think you do have to go that far, because that's kind of what he's doing, and he's sort of making us sort of look at how we treat each other and what we find funny and why do we find that funny?
Well, yes, and I suppose it's a modern thing to start looking at the cruelties of that. Portia herself has no control over her life. She's got to marry the person who chooses the right casket, which, of course, we know is going to be the right person, but might not have been. And the ones who fail are doomed not to have anyone else.
That's true. I mean, again, this is the other, you know, another, you know, ambiguous thing about the play and the stories within it. There is some, and certainly the way that we've sort of been playing it, and we rehearsed it, was that, you know, in the singing of the song, there might be something in terms of trying to encourage Bassani and Cheese. I mean, this thing of, you know...
A bit of clues,
like, you know, the end of every the word at the end of every line rhymes with lead. And, you know, some sort of subliminal kind of clues being given during the song. I mean, you know... I think it's there, and so in terms of saying that she is, she has no control over her destiny, may not be altogether true. I mean, even she even talks to Nerissa about. I mean, we've cut the lines, but talks about putting a glass of Rhenish wine on the casket, on the wrong casket, to encourage the German suitor to choose it, so that he gets, you know, so he chooses the one which has got the drink. I don't know if she's altogether, if she hasn't got any choice on the matter. I think that she's just not been very happy with the kind of people who've turned up to choose. But, you know.
Well, there's also the relationship between Antonio and Bassanio. I mean, he does actually say in the court, when he doesn't realise his wife is there, that he has more... he loves Antonio more than his wife. I think he uses the word, doesn't he?
He does, yeah. He does. I mean, look, there's so much written about and talked about and speculation about that, the nature of that relationship.
Yeah.
I think, though, it's another example of this thing of promising one thing and doing another. I mean, there's a kind of sense in this play that he's examining oaths, what it is to make an oath to someone, we've seen him in the scene before swear to his, you know, to his wife, the woman who's going to be his wife, that he will never take the ring off his finger and all that, and it's a delight to see him do that for us, you know, and that's been a brilliant reaction with the audiences here.
When they see not to give it away,
yeah, and every time he takes that ring off, he goes, oh, Gratiano, God. And to be fair to him, he doesn't actually really want to, but he's put under a bit of pressure by Antonio. And he breaks the oath. He takes that ring off, and he gives it to Gratiano. And the audience is going, no, you know, they're screaming out for him not to do it. Again, it's another great example of these young people are really in tune with what it is to promise something and then to break your promise. And that's great to see. And I think that it's a similar thing going on in the trial, isn't it? I mean, he absolutely loves his friend. He totally, you know, he loves him. He doesn't want to see him die. And I don't know, he's in an extreme situation, and he says something because he thinks that obviously has no idea that his wife is actually there. And, you know, I'm sure he's not the first person to have, you know, said, you know, done something like that. You know.
Well, another very interesting character in the play is Jessica. And I love the way you show her confusion at the end, because there isn't, she's not actually given anything in the text, is she? She's just sort of forgotten about. And yet she's changed her whole life, and her father has now been treated horribly by these people she's decided to go along with. I think it's very good that you show her feeling perhaps even isolated, certainly confused at the end.
Well, yeah, thank you. It's a funny scene. Famously tricky scene. I mean, you know, again, much has been written about it and everyone has their own take on it. This play was, you know, recorded as a comedy. And obviously in comedy, at the end of, you know, comedies, people get married and everything ends happily ever after. And so, you know, Shylock leaves the court, converted, and we then go back to Belmont and see the couples resolve their differences, and everyone, you know, is very happy. It troubled me, this last scene. It troubled us in rehearsal, and as you say, she says, once Bassani has arrived back with Antonio, she says nothing, Jessica, she says nothing. She hears how they've made Shylock pay, you know, his ultimate price. And as we know, you know, he's been tricked in terms of, and everyone's been tricked, because actually the person who's sort of, you know, pioneered this is Portia, dressed up as a man, in the courtroom. And again, brilliant to see Portia winning the day. Fantastic, incredibly intelligent, beautifully argued, and yet tricking everybody. That last scene, Jessica, just, you know, she's on the fringes of the scene. She hears how her father has been, you know, ruined, destroyed, and is not given any lines.
No.
And it is fascinating why he chooses not to do that. And as you say, so we, you know, we wanted, I sort of felt we needed to make something of it. Again, there's nothing to say that, you know, Gratiano and Nerissa, having had that big argument, you know, there's nothing said that they should come together happily as a happy couple. And so we got a little bit of, you know, we have the couples leaving individually off the stage. You know, so we've got Bassanio and Portia leave, kind of resolved. You sort of feel that they've probably got a sort of, you've probably got a future. They seem to end on a fairly positive note. They go off. And then Nerissa and Gratiano sort of, you know, there's a bit of tension there. I mean, he's not happy after what she's done to him. I mean, he says, "What are we to be cuckolds before, you know, we've even started, you know, a relationship really?" And then Jessica's left on her own, and there's that money which is left from the which Portia gave Bassanio to pay off Shylock, which he doesn't accept. So that's come back in that last scene. And so we have Jessica going up to this money and just kind of considering this new life that she's kind of left everything for. And
stolen from her father.
And stolen from her father. And, you know, there's that wonderful moment where Lorenzo, you know, has kind of like stolen Jessica, and she throws down the casket and he goes, "I love her heartily," or something like that. You know, this sense of all this money that I'm getting, it's wonderful. And the very last thing that happens in that scene is, at the end, is that they're given that, you know, the document which said that he and Jessica will inherit everything once Charlotte's died. And he's over the moon, you know. He says, "This is manna from heaven," or something. I'm paraphrasing. And she says nothing. And so it felt right to, you know, especially, you know, with this sort of modern audience, to give her the last say in some way. So we have this sort of moment, which is sort of represents her kind of dilemma between her heart and her and her head, I suppose, and her decision to go to this new life of riches and something which is kind of alien to her.
Yes. Yes, because she went into it in the first place, partly to escape rather than to go to something.
Exactly, and now she's kind of like, having been isolated, living with her father, she's sort of she feels more isolated than she ever was before. And I mean, we have actually this production, you know, of, I felt it was right, you know, like with all Globe shows, you sort of end with a jig. So we knew that everybody would have to come on stage. And so, you know, we're thinking, well, try and tie in getting Charlotte back on stage with a little moment with Jessica. So we have Jessica with this money ending up throwing the money up in the air, and out of the sort of flourish of banknotes, Shylock sort of appears, and they sort of they start the jig together, and then she brings him onto the stage with everybody else, and they all join together. Yeah. Kind of representing a kind of her ideal kind of, you know, fantasy, you know, world where her father would be part of this new life with her, and vice versa.
It is difficult, that, though, isn't it, having to bring Shylock back in a completely different mood, really.
Yes, it is. And it's, you know, it is difficult. And it's, you know, I wouldn't want to think anyone to think that we've sort of rewritten the end of the play, which we haven't. It just happens to be the way that we bring him on stage.
Yeah.
In some ways, I feel that it kind of... it sorts out the trickiness at the end of the play. I mean, yeah, we could have not brought him on at all, but I think that, you know, that's not right. I think he needs to be seen at the end.
Well, the argument always is that the jig sort of takes us back into life away from fantasy life on the stage.
Exactly, and that's kind of it. That's a kind of, you know, we start this production as well with the actors in the yard talking to the audience. They come through and they sing a song at the beginning, which takes us into the play, and we kind of wanted to end like that too, so it's like we do come full circle, really. So by the end they are just a bunch of actors dancing. But I think it's I think it's an interesting way to bring him back on stage.
Yes, I thought it was very brave of you to get them into such a state of almost hysteria at the beginning before it starts. I thought, how on earth are they going to quiet them enough to listen? But they go quiet. They went quiet immediately.
They do. I mean, I think that one of the things we discovered 8 years ago when we did the first show was when the show starts, when someone stands on stage in that extraordinary theatre, the crowd of 1,500 young people erupts, and you have to kind of let that happen.
Give them that moment.
Give them that moment. And so, in fact, what we do, we try and use it to our advantage in terms of setting up the world a little bit. So, we have this tune. It happens to be a massive hit at the moment, which is a Pharrell Williams song, "Happy," and this kind of world, which is all about. I mean, we want to set up this idea of this world, which is everybody on the surface is really, really happy and making loads of money, spending loads of money. They sing this song, "I'm Happy," and then it's a mashup with "Money." That's What I Want. I think the Beatles sung it originally, and it works quite well as a mashup. And then it goes back into "Happy," and then they do this brilliantly choreographed kind of sequence, choreographed by George Lamb, which is this kind of world of like the one I was talking about before, which we see in these, you know, gossip mags now, you know, kind of a really sort of expensive kind of cocktail kind of bar, loads of champagne, everyone dancing, everyone having a great time, and it's setting up this world of Venice as a neat sort of backdrop for us, and the audiences are going sort of wild in that, but it sort of allows them to get a sense of the world, to let the energy out a little bit before the very first words, you know, "See if I know not why I'm so sad." And as you say, I mean, every time, you know, they're quiet when Antonio speaks, and it's fantastic.
Yes, brilliant reactions from the audience, really.
It's fantastic.
Well, you don't keep it a secret that this is all about money, this play. I mean, you've got all the glisters, it's not gold on the wall outside the the Globe. Yeah. And
I mean, that's a marketing tool. That wasn't a design choice, but it does work really, really well.
Yeah.
And you know, we covered the pillars with gold llamas. It's very, very bright, very shiny, and I think it's a kind of, we want to get the sense of this. We have the design. We have this brilliant design by Simon Kenny. Venice lit up in sort of neon on the back. Mm. I mean, look, it's an hour and a half. We have to make strong statements, I felt, and create the sense of a world where, you know, bright lights, big city, somewhere where you really want to go, somewhere which is all about money. Venice, you know, 400 years ago, as we understand it, was. I mean, it was this hub of international trade and really exotic, thrillingly exciting place where, you know, most people in England would never have been there, would have heard extraordinary stories about the carnivals and, you know, those exotic kind of people who lived there and the amount of money that you can make. And so we sort of wanted to get a sense of that here. I mean, it kind of works brilliantly, the Globe, covering those pillars with gold. I mean, it looks like they almost, you know, that they're like that all the time. Mm. It looks great, but of course it's a sense of the surface, a sense of, you know, that's just the surface. What's underneath is something.
And of course, modern dress. You said that.
Yeah, modern dress.
And Jessica really looks like a schoolgirl, doesn't she?
Yeah, I mean, yes, she does. And you know, if it's important for us to enable, you know, the audiences to kind of feel that, like, they could identify with characters. Mm. I mean, it's not to say that we couldn't have done it in sort of an original practices type show, but you know, we chose to go with something a bit more contemporary, something which you wouldn't necessarily be able to do in a, you know, main season show, and you know, I think it works really well for this play.
Yes, well, you've still got a very few performances left, I think.
Yeah, we have. We've got the last show's on Saturday afternoon, a family show. It's been great, as you say. We've played during the week to young people from schools, and then on Saturdays they are sort of family shows. So people of all ages come and have enjoyed it. So it's not just a production which has been enjoyed by teenagers. It's been enjoyed by all ages.
And I believe Deutsche Bank has signed up to do more. Isn't that right? I believe so.
Well, that's great. I hope so. I mean, they've been incredible supporters, and it's a fantastic project, and we're incredibly proud and happy to be involved with it. And I sort of wish that when I was 14, I'd been able to, you know, partake in a project like this myself and see it and do workshops around it, because I think it's a great thing.
Yes. Well, thanks very much, Bill, and enjoy Hamlet.
Thank you.